Warning, this is not your father's history. This is not the history your coach taught you in high school. And you won't find it on the History Channel either. No, you see, this is the history your mother warned you about. This is History Against the Grain with your hosts, Chris Padgett and Josh Weiner.
Episode 62, Experts in a Dying Field. Welcome to the podcast where we, in the words of Walter Benjamin, regard it as our task to brush history against the grain. I'm one of your hosts, Josh Weiner, and with me as always, my co-host, Chris Padgett. How are you doing, Chris? And happy spring break to all who celebrate.
Thank you, and yes, spring break is indeed a happy time. I know for both of us, it's more of a working break.
Yes, a little bit.
It's fine. You've reached a certain age, right, in your life where vacation sounds good because you can actually get some work done that you want to get.
It's gross, yeah.
That's probably very unhealthy.
Yeah. I was thinking about this a few weeks ago, but, you know, there's that old adage of, who I don't even know who came up with it, but like if you choose a job you love, you never work a day in your life. And what I realize, if you do work based on something you love, then you're always working. You can never escape work because it's just the thing you do. So there's that downside to it. But yeah, this is a spring break in name only in some ways. I don't have to go to campus and, you know, I'm not doing the regular stuff, but got all the regular workload other than that. So
I hope you're finding an indulgence here and there, though. I really do. The sort of thing that you might only do, you know, during spring break, like driving over to Santa Cruz and having a BLT or something.
That's more your pastime than mine.
Okay. Well, we have our own indulgences.
Yeah. Well, you haven't been on, you know, on a regular episode in a while. Our last episode was our panel from the AHA, and you haven't, you know, I spoke about that in the intro to that episode, and hopefully people listened and enjoyed that, but we haven't had your thoughts on that experience of AHA. And so, you know, we don't need to spend the whole episode on it, but it'd be nice to get your perspective on what went down there. And then we can maybe talk about some of the stuff that's been going on since January in our professional lives, but also in our field.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I feel entitled. I mean, I crammed myself into the fuselage of some crappy Southwest Airlines jet, you know, to get all the way back to Philly. The least I could do is, you know, is represent a little bit here. And well, first of all, I would say the first and best thing I can say about our time there was that we did meet and had some really good food, including what was my single most important directive, to have a Philly cheesesteak sandwich. So Philly did not disappoint that way, even got a little bit of sightseeing in, which, you know, let's face it, Josh, when you're a historian doing sightseeing, it's maybe a little bit different because we kind of come in with a certain kind of raised eyebrow skepticism about how public history is presented, particularly, you know, in Philadelphia, we're talking about Independence Hall and that sort of thing. And, you know, I'm happy to say they, you know, the National Park Service, I'm glad we have it, you know, it's, you know, those people and the docents, the park rangers, you know, are all doing their level best and doing a pretty good job. You know, but being a jaded ass skeptic historian, you know, late capitalist historian, as we say today, you know, working in a vanishing field or a dying field, you see it a little bit differently. And, you know, we can talk about that later. But so Philadelphia was, you know, the best of times. I don't think it was the worst of times. I think our session, our panel was a lot of fun. I think we had a good time with it, which is, you know, really critical. You know, if you're going to spend all that money and do all that, you know, go have a good time with it. It's different when you're employed, right, than when you're going there as a mendicant, you know, a starving grad student hoping to scare up some kind of, you know, job opportunity, which that was me. So what a difference 20 years made. Because the last time, you know, I went back east in the freezing winter, I think it was in Washington, D.C. then, you know, to look for a job, it was, utterly demoralizing. And we're going to talk about that too. But the best parts of it, seeing some old friends, we saw your brother Benno and some of our friends, I call them the Pittsburgh History Mafia, you know, was great. Some of our past guests on History Against the Grain, some really talented, smart historians. So yeah, in my capsule summary, I would say we had a great time, and we managed to pull off that session, which is, after all, our only formal responsibility was to hold that session. And I think we did okay.
We did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as the person who edits these, I'm a little, I can't help but feel a sense of things could have gone better with the sound, because I think right before we started, I think it was Mike Van who said, should we speak right into the microphones? And I'm like, no, I think it'll be okay. So if I have one thing back, it would maybe be to say, yes, you should all speak directly into the microphones. But other than that, yeah, the session was a blast. And I thought the group that was there watching and taking part was great, as well as our fellow panelists. So, but
yeah, the
you know,
title was the Can We Save the Survey, right? Is it worth the history survey? That is the standard freshman history survey. You know, is it worth saving? Can it be saved? Is it worth saving, kind of thing? And, you know, given that my essential point was no and no, I thought it went pretty well. You know, I think I sense that a lot of our attendees may have been world historians, and that may account for some of it. You know, as I was talking down about, you know, the loathsome U.S. history survey, nobody seemed to be too bothered by it.
No. And, you know, it was just a reminder. You said, you know, last time you were at the AHA, you were as a mendicant searching for a job. You know, last time I had been as well was literally about 20 years before. I think it was 2004 in Seattle. And, you know, I was still in grad school, wasn't quite ready for the job market yet. But what was interesting then is that there was like one world history panel, and people were like, wow, they actually have a world history panel at this one. So that's how far things have come. I think world history was much more of a, if not, you know, specifically world history panels, the World History Association was very present there. And then, you know, the panels, even if they weren't technically world history, definitely had a broader focus than I think was the norm in past decades and past meetings. So, there's some progress.
Yeah. There's a footprint there, a discernible footprint now for world history. And in fact, you and I, and our colleague Ed Hashima spent, you know, a lovely morning session, I think Friday morning, right?
Yeah.
Dedicated to, you know, the recalling of a book, you know, one of the, you know, sort of path-breaking, you know, history books that was published in the late 90s by a historian named Michael Gomez.
Yeah. Exchanging Our Country Marks was the book.
Changing Our Country Marks. And it was a lovely session because it brought in people who were really pioneers in the whole field of African diaspora history, including your mentor at Northeastern, Pat Manning, who recorded a piece, and it was up on the big screen. He wasn't there in person, but it was up on the big screen. So we got to hear from Pat and the panelists. And I found it, you know, really pretty moving, actually, because, you know, what does it take to move the rock of historical inertia? You know, I'm talking about this history profession, you know, where, like any profession, you get conventional ways of doing things, you know, and there's a conservative impulse to sort of preserve those ways. And so here come these diaspora historians. I don't even know, probably didn't even call them diaspora historians at the time. You know, there wasn't maybe even a name for what they were doing. You know,
no,
but connecting the history of Africa with the larger Atlantic world had been seen as an unbridgeable gulf, because, you know, people, the way we're trained in our silos, you know, people who are trained in, say, U.S. history, were not trained, maybe took no classes in African history, you know, and probably the reverse of that was true. So they had to, people like Gomez had to, and Pat and others had to make up this field out of a really kind of whole cloth, you know, where they could demonstrate a willingness and a competence in doing both sides, as it were, you know, African history, having some fluency in African history, but then also find discernible connections in the Western Hemisphere, in the Americas, for example. So that was a really cool experience at the AHA. One of the highlights for sure.
No, it was really cool because one of the things that struck me as you were saying is that these are, you know, particularly the senior scholars there, the discussant was a one of their grad students. They all had to, you know, kind of, as you said, just reach across these boundaries and borders that exist in the field that told them, you know, this is not how you approach this subject, that you have to do it in this kind of national lens. For instance, you have to be an African historian, or you have to be an historian of African Americans in the United States, basically. And you weren't allowed to kind of cross borders and boundaries in the way that has become more normalized now. And so they each had to, you know, essentially, as you said, like break out of their fields as they existed and redefine what you could do as an historian and who you could study and how you could study them. And what was cool is that the discussant, you know, for her, it was easier because of the work that the senior scholars had done, because of the way they had kind of been those path breakers, and kind of, you know, define this field of diaspora studies. And so really inspiring as a session, and so inspiring that I don't think I went to any other sessions for the rest of the HA. But yeah, it was a great way to start the whole thing, definitely.
Yeah, I know you went to one others that one other that was ours. And
I was there, yeah.
just for context here, you know, before diaspora history, the thing we're talking about, there was, I mean, you had some anthropologists, right? Somebody like Sidney Mintz did his work on sugar, you know, the cultivation of sugar plantations of the New World. And then going all the way back to the 40s, you had this guy, Melville Herskovitz, who was a Wisconsin anthropologist as well. So it was mostly anthropologists who were interested in trying to discern whether any surviving traces of African identity, culture, et cetera, survived the slave trade. You know, people leaving Africa under duress, involuntarily, in what we call the Atlantic slave trade, arriving, those who survive, you know, arriving by the millions over several centuries to become enslaved laborers in the you know, the habitations now, the colonial habitations of the New World. So, you know, where did that leave then the subsequent history of, like you say, those who we might call African American people, you know, those who are living in what becomes the United States, let's say in North America. You know, is there any sense that there's a discernible African inheritance throughout that history, or was it just all simply abolished, you know, under the, you know, the dire gravity of the Atlantic slave trade or something? You know, because in the 60s, it was, you know, scholars were very interested in trying to find roots, right? I mean, in the 70s, we had Alex Haley and Roots, you know, the aptly named Roots, broadcast on ABC. So it, but it was murky, you know, and it was difficult to assess. The field had to be defined. You had to have competence, you know, methodological, et cetera. And then you had to have the opportunity to publish this stuff. Did you, first of all, do the research? Think about the research that diaspora historians have to do. I mean, they're essentially potentially what, three continents at least, right? You know, you're going to European archives, you're going to African, you know, archives. You know, you're going obviously in the Americas, the West Indies. It was an ambitious undertaking, but one that was so necessary, I guess, to fill those voids of understanding. Because as I say, otherwise, you know, for Black lives in the Americas, they're essentially what, historical orphans, you know? There's no other than the most generic sort of African past, you know, which then lent itself to all kinds of, you know, probably well-intended, but, you know, historically incorrect kinds of, there was a big thing, right, with, you know, Swahili, right, you know, in the 60s and identifying, you know, Swahili words. But, you know, Swahili was East Africa, you know, and most of these, you know, people are coming out of West Africa, and there's a wide gap, you know, there, culturally, historically, et cetera, so linguistically. So, yeah, I mean, I hope our listeners can appreciate, you know, when we talk about this sort of thing, you know, it's an extraordinary moment, you know, in the work of professional history. And so it was a lot of fun to be there and listen to him talk a bit about what that was like.
Yeah, and just to talk about Michael Gomez a little bit more, because I don't know that we've talked about his work, you know, at least directly. I think he's probably inspired some stuff we talked about. But Gomez, you know, his start actually was in Islamic history. And he talks about in his book, African Dominion, this, you know, I talked about boundaries and barriers a bit ago, that, you know, what he decided he wanted to do was study Islam in West Africa. And his, I think it was in a graduate class, and the instructor was like, no, that's not really what you should be doing. And he did it anyway. And so he became basically a guy who had first, you know, studied Islamic history and then turned that into a study of Islam in West Africa, and then just became an African historian. And what made Exchanging Our Country Marks so incredible in some ways is because he essentially wrote this book about basically the continuation of African identities in North America, but he did so as somebody trained in African history, not somebody trained in American history. Mm-hmm. And some of the other people there, Leslie Alexander, Margaret Washington, were two of the other senior scholars, spoke about how inspiring that was for them as people trained in U.S. history with an African-American focus, as it was usually defined, realizing that they could take from African history in a way that was, you know, enrich their field in ways. And I just want to also credit the chair, Shauna Johnson of University of Chicago. She was the graduate student who was, I believe, was she Leslie Alexander's student, or Leslie Alexander was her advisor?
Yeah, she was the student of the panel. You're right.
Yeah.
Margaret Washington, just to throw in, I mean, just as an illustration, she did a book on the Gullah culture of South Carolina, Seacoast Islands, you know, in the day of age of slavery. And I mean, look, if you're going to talk about the Gullah, you know, you had to have some kind of fluency with African culture, you know, African mm-hmm. language in particular, and African, you know, agricultural traditions and other things. Because it was such a remarkable kind of Creole, hybridized Creole culture. And she called her book A Most Peculiar People, which was a line that she pulled out of one of the primary sources, right, that struck her. But she said she got a lot of pushback for that title because sort of, you know, folks who saw themselves as the guardians of, you know, Black pride, Black power, thought it was disparaging to say A Most Peculiar People. Mm-hmm. I mean, it touches on other things, a peculiar institution. You know, these are sort of, you know, white shibboleths used to kind of denigrate Black lives. And she said, well, she kept it because it came out of the primary source. But it was also true that this Creole culture was in some, you know, many, many respects, you know, was remarkable for what it seemed to harbor in terms of these hybridized, Creolized African, you know, cultural traditions. And so look, they're having to figure out what to call things, you know, how to frame them in a narrative. They're getting pushback from people who they think are going to probably support them, but, you know, for editorial reasons, don't like what they're calling things. I mean, it was really cool.
Definitely. And it, you know, as inspiring as that session was, and as good of experience overall, I think the AHA was, there definitely was this kind of, you know, black cloud over the whole proceedings. And I think, you know, just kind of this general weight that has only increased over the past few months since then, which is just this feeling that, you know, as the title of this episode suggests, that we are experts in a dying field, that history as a discipline is in crisis right now. And, you know, maybe that was discussed a little bit at the HA. There were sessions that maybe kind of got to that, maybe, you know, peripherally,
like, but, ours.
Like ours, yes. Thank you. As one example, but they're as bad as things seem maybe in January for our field, it seems like it's only gotten worse since then, for reasons that are both very specific to, you know, where we're employed and where we teach and do our work, but also just more broadly, for the historical discipline, which is seeing a huge contraction. In terms of full-time faculty, in terms of enrollment, and then in terms of just, you know, funding and all of these basic things, it's certainly dark times for our field.
Yeah, you know, I'm calling it these days the history profession's existential crisis.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, look, if we had a subtitle to the name of our podcast, History Against the Grain, it might be something like history against the grain or what we better do to save our profession. And yes. He said modestly, you know, I want to cast us as the messiah figures of the history. Right. But no, seriously, I mean, because we were inspired by what was happening in 2019, 2020. So you're right, since January, but also since, you know, the pre-quarantine times, you know, four times, things were already shaping up to be difficult. We had the Trump administration with its anti-intellectualism, its attack, and we have the legacy of that now. You know, we have House Bill 999. I thought they should have called it House Bill 666.
Yeah, but anyway, they were better.
House Bill 999 in Florida, which is still, I guess, under consider. I don't think it's become law yet.
I don't think so.
In any event, you know, it's essentially proscribing what can be taught in history classes. It's part of a larger assault in Florida on tenure rights for faculty. In some cases, you know, whole departments either being, you know, essentially gutted or otherwise restricted. So this is more than just a couple of ivory tower types like you and me, Josh, you know, sitting around gazing at our navels. I mean, there are actual legislative assaults going on right now. And not just in Florida, by the way, but, you know, most probably notably in Florida, going on to either diminish, restrict, censor, you know, what can even be done in history. So on the one hand, there's that part of the existential crisis.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of these things where, on the one hand, you know, us in California can maybe sit back and say, well, that's Florida and it's not going to happen here. But that's not the end of the crisis either. You know, those laws, which, I mean, you said they prescribe certain types of history. In some cases, they literally criminalize certain types of teaching. I think there's second degree felonies for certain, you know, using certain terms in classes and this sort of stuff. So that's bad enough. But just more generally, even in states that are maybe, you know, in theory, at least more sympathetic to the historical discipline, we're still seeing the contractions, I said, of history departments, less of an emphasis on students even getting any history before they get their degrees. And then one of the ways it's also playing out is the collapse of the job market, which, you know, I think no matter which generation you're in as an historian, you probably enter the job market with people telling you, well, it's not as good as it used to be. You know, that was what I was told 20 years ago. That's probably what you were told, you know, the decade before that. And you could probably keep going back and back, but there's you know, no argument that it's not the worst it's ever been right now. And this is seen in the numbers of hires, the number of grad students who are not getting full-time tenure track jobs. Our department is down 30% in terms of full-timers. And that seems to be a pretty normal percentage across the country, that you look at history departments at major universities and they're down, you know, 25, 30, 35% of full-time faculty. And that leaves, you know, graduate students who come out of graduate school, they have their degree. The degree offers this promise of employment in their chosen field, and they're just no jobs out there. And so, you know, where does that leave us? I think that's the big question.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the big questions. And I think it's tied up with a bunch of other questions we're going to talk about today. You know, we're supposed to be historians, right? This always cracks me up, you know, when sort of historians sort of sit around kind of like, you know, little poor Henny Penny, you know, and the sky is falling. It's like, oh, these large unseen forces, you know, what's happening? You know, and it's like, we're supposed to be the ones that can answer that question, you know, like, here's what's happened, you know, here's the cause and effect of it. That's kind of supposed to be our stock and trade, isn't it? Cause and effect. One thing causes something else. But somehow when it turns to the history of our own profession, you know, people, their eyes glass over, you know, and we've found this to be true just in trying to create reforms, you know, in our college and in our district, where we're talking about everything from, you know, particularly curriculum, renaming certain courses and, you know, introducing new curriculum, but also in job hires, you know, silly, naive types that we are, thinking we're going to actually get some new hires to replace, you know, the retirees, and wanting to do it in a thoughtful way and not just sort of replicate the past. And again, we're supposed to be uniquely positioned to appreciate that as historians, but somehow when it comes to our own affairs, sometimes we become as, you know, fossilized, as sort of, you know, in sort of enslaved to traditions within the discipline and other, you know, as anybody could be. You sent me a piece from the Chronicle of Higher Education the other day. Of the 1,799 historians, 1,799 historians who earned their PhD in a 2-year period from 2019 to 2020. So just before the, you know, COVID crisis, of the almost 1,800 historians who earned their PhD, the AHA, and that's in a nation now of over 300 million, right?
Yes.
Just in case you're thinking, well, God, that's too many people getting history PhDs. In a nation over 300 million, we could run the numbers on that, what percentage that is. The AHA, are one of our main professional organizations, could definitively locate only 175 of those almost 1,800 now employed in full-time faculty positions in the field.
Not great.
Not great numbers, no. And you know, again, perspective, you're right. I heard this coming through grad school, you know, that more PhDs were driving pizza delivery than were actually in tenured jobs.
Right.
I was routinely told even then, this was in the late 80s, early 90s, that, you know, I wasn't going to find a tenure check job and all that. So, but I would say, you know, that we're still living in that moment. In other words, as I've sort of, you know, rehearsed it for you, I think what happened in this country is that we had what I call the Cold War dividend, especially in systems like the University of California system, which were given these lavish contracts, federal contracts after World War II, particularly for military defense research, you know. Mm-hmm. And so in California, you had, you know, the Lawrence Livermore Lab, the Lawrence Lab at Berkeley, atomic scientists, you know, Robert Oppenheimer came from Berkeley.
Right.
And so California, Northern California itself was transformed. The town we work in, Sacramento, was transformed. It had military bases. It had systems research, including, you know, literal rocket science, right? So that brought a whole lot of money in the Cold War, money that could then be spent, you know, to build these departments. You know, most of my professors at Davis came out in the early 60s, came out from the East Coast. I remember one of the guys telling me, his colleagues would say, oh, don't go to California. It's lotus land. You know, it's the land of the lotus eaters, you're right, from Homer, that, you know, you eat the flowers and you fall asleep. You'll never do any work out in California. Mm-hmm. So they were all migrants from the Ivy League, basically, that came out here because the jobs, the departments were flush with cash, new positions being created. But most of it, in my sense of the story, also has a Cold War component, because the idea was, if we're going to beat the Russians to the moon, we also have to create, you know, a standard U.S. history course that will explain to everybody, especially, you know, new immigrants, you know, why America is the defender of the free world. In other words, there was a political component to all this funding for history. And it's no surprise that in those years, the leaders of the U.S. history field were people who were writing what we now call consensus histories. Explaining, I've talked about this in earlier episodes, why the U.S. was born of the seeds of liberty, how the founding fathers, you know, like the tribes of Israel, bequeathed to us, you know, the advantages of democracy compared to what? The communist bloc, right? Red China, you know, I mean, the language from the age, that history was, in a sense, part of, it was weaponized, in other words, in the Cold War fight. And I think what happened, you know, in the 80s and by the 90s, when I was finishing, when you were about to come up, is that that Cold War dividend was already starting to withdraw, because what? The Cold War was over. The Cold War was over.
I think so. And I think there's the other factor there is something that we talked about with Priya Sadia, who makes this case that, you know, that history became the field of mutiny. I'm blanking on the phrase now. It became, you know, basically
the
that
reign of mutiny or something.
Yeah, that, you know, all this funding came in, all these historians started coming up, and a lot of those historians now became the center of this kind of counter cultural, we'll just say, approach to the discipline, right? And at a certain point, you know, why is the state going to continue funding people who are making arguments that undermine the maybe not undermine the state, but undermine the legitimizing narrative of the state at the very least? You know, in world history, the story is a little different because, you know, similarly in the Cold War, there became this great need, or at least this perceived need, to have subject experts on the rest of the world. And that's where area studies came up, you know, so African studies, Asian studies, this sort of thing. And so you could train a bunch of people who could, you know, theoretically go into academia, but also could then become, you know, experts in for the CIA, for the State Department, that sort of thing. And a lot of world historians ultimately came out of that area studies background, which again emerged and got financed through that Cold War dividend that you mentioned. And you know, it just doesn't seem like that money is available anymore. It doesn't seem like the interest is available anymore. And, you know, as former President Obama told us, learn to code, right? Which I think is gonna end up as one of the underrated gross moments of the Obama years. You know, there's other moments as well, but, you know, just this moment where it really signaled, you know, for that liberal order. And I even talked about conservatives and their disdain of education, but for liberals, this idea that solution was always coding and STEM, and the solution was not going to come from these disciplines like history, like sociology, like anthropology, like English, even for that matter, which now can come to be seen more and more. And I think they were already seen this way prior, but as these kind of boutique majors, they're not really, you know, useful in that sense. They're not going to get you jobs, but their funding was, you know, out of this very specific moment. And I think we just kind of culturally changed. People don't see that the value anymore. And so they are just seen as, you know, fields you can study if you don't really need a job, you know, and it's not a great look for our field. Now, the problem is, as you talked about, is
they want one student in that New Yorker article you sent me called it a hobby. In other words, you major in something else, but you study history, humanities, literature, et cetera, just as a hobby, you know, sort of to do, I don't know, on spring break or something.
No, which is, that line hit me pretty hard. You know, you talked about how historians are supposed to be able to think about cause and effect and this sort of thing. But I think part of the problem that was highlighted at AHA is that the most prestigious people in our field, right, the people who get the pages in major journals and in popular magazines and who write books, you know, they're already tenure track, you know, they're in place. They've got, you know, these secure jobs in these big universities. And so for them, the jobs crisis is something that's out there, but it's kind of ephemeral to them. And the result is that, you know, maybe we're experts in the dying field, but the field doesn't really seem to be addressing the crisis. And so that the piece I send you from the Chronicle of Higher Education is by a graduate student named Jacob Brugman, who was at the AHA. And he just speaks to the weird disconnect of being at this place as a graduate student, one who was hoping to get a full-time job, seeing the crisis in the job market and not hearing anybody address that as a crisis. He was at, you know, we've talked about James Sweet, the now former president of the AHA. And we had a whole episode talking about how the problem of presentism that he diagnosed and why his diagnosis was wrong. But he got up, you know, and did his presidential address at the AHA meeting. And Jacob Brugman kind of describes this moment. He talks about the dilapidated room and the dilapidated historians in that room listening to Sweet's talk. And he reflected in this piece, says, 50 years from now, Sweet's keynote may be remembered as a morbid symptom of a profession in terminal decline. The ballroom and the profession it hosted had both seen better times. So yeah, it was a kind of a grim reflection on this meeting, you know, which, you know, for us, it was kind of triumphal in some ways. Our panel went really well, but again, you know, from a different perspective, there was a lot of darkness going on, at this meeting, and hearing, this piece by Jacob Brugman really, I think, highlighted some of that. problems and our inability to kind of face those problems head on.
Yeah, when you say our ability
As a
as
profession,
a
yeah, as a,
discipline, because I think you and I are doing a hell of a job,
yes.
you know, of at least facing the problems as messianic figures with a podcast. And again, Bergman's piece was great. Down and Out at the AHA, it was called. You know, he says, do these fields offer paths for professional disciplinary revival, or are they merely the last tickets off a sinking ship? So you can have some fun with metaphors there. But I have to say, I'm not especially hopeful. I mean, I don't think historians typically invest in that kind of hopey, changey ethic, you know, because when you work in a mortuary like we do, and all you see are dead people, kind of sober you to the ultimate, destiny of living things. But no, seriously, I mean, I think there's what the ancient Greeks would have called stasis, you know, stasis, this internal conflict, because at the same time you had that Cold War dividend with all those consensus, you know, sort of patriotic histories. You know, you had what happening in the world? You had decolonization, independence movements, the crumbling of empires. You had racial pride movement, Black power in the U.S., you know, Chicano power in the U.S. You had ethnic or racial groups that typically had been, you know, on the wrong side of that power divide in the imperial systems, you know, who are now beginning to assert themselves, assert their identities, assert their histories. So all of that is happening at the same time, you know. And so what, you go to the conference, and I got to believe, you know, it's like a Jim Crow bus or something, right? You know, you have 50, you know, sessions at the American History Conference dealing with the thoughts of the founding fathers, you know, and then you have what, maybe one session dealing with something like, you know, African-American experience in the American Revolution or something, you know, whatever. In other words, there was such a lopsided divide for so long. And then, so what began to happen? It began to redress, you know, because those scholars, those graduate students grew up doing that more, we'll call it radical history. Sometimes it was called New Left history. Sometimes it was called New History, that was pushing back against that consensus history. And once those grad students grew up and became tenured professors, you know, because there was still money for that in the whatever in the 60s and 70s, you know, that started to change. But what we're seeing now, I think, is it's still, well, how would you describe that, you know, as the tension now, the stasis now, still exists between those who somehow see, both in terms of content and methodology, see the profession in very traditional terms, very conventional terms, particularly something like national histories.
Yeah.
You know, which are just assumed to be the natural sort of, you know, vehicle for telling about the past, like the U.S. history, you know, versus those who are saying, no, wait a minute, what this new scholarship over the years has taught us is that there are many other stories outside that paradigm, you know, like African diaspora histories, et cetera, you know, that will give us actually greater insight into this world that we're living in. And so that tension is still, I think, very much there, you know, Josh. And I would like to think, you know, in terms of the battle, who's winning the battle, you know, as you said at the AHA, if just counting up the number of sessions now that are given over to world history and that sort of thing, I'd like to say that as we go into the middle rounds of this fight, that new history is actually scoring a lot of points, you know, but what for every, you know, action, there's an equal opposite reaction. So the bill in Florida, the attack on the 1619 project, and even sometimes closer to home, you know, poor, you know, our lamented AHA historian Jim Sweet, ostensibly one of the architects of that new history, you know, find other reasons in the culture war to argue against it, you know. And then on top of that, as you pointed out, we got this whole sea change going on in education generally, which is what we call the transactional model of higher ed, you know. And I was there, I feel like I was there at the creation, at the guy from the Brookings Institute in DC back in 93, who came and talked to us at the UC Center there about how, You know, he had tried to call the New York City public school system to get a simple answer to a simple question, and how he was put on hold and switched and passed around for 30 minutes. He said no business could ever survive being that efficient, you know, as the New York public city school system. And so there was this idea that you put education on what? On the market terms. You know, you manage it the way corporations get managed, with managers, middle managers, higher managers. And that the outcomes become more important. The bottom line now is student success, which is measured in quantitative terms as the number of students getting degrees in a certain amount of time. So we're very much living in that transactional, you know, I want to cue the Pink Floyd music here, money, right? You know, with the sound of the cash register. We're very much in that transactional mode, which, if things weren't already tough enough here in the end of days, you know, we got that to deal with, don't we?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, here's the real problem, right, is that if we are, in fact, as Priya had said, I think it's a discipline of mutiny, maybe. And we're also having this increasingly transactional system of education, you know, which is basically middle management dominating, and scholars like us, educators in general, just as employees of these middle managers who like to talk of themselves as, quote, the leadership team. I've seen that term way too often lately. You know, if we're going into our classrooms and part of what we're saying is that systems like the one they're promoting are bad, then it's not really a surprise in the end that they're not really seeing us as vital to education, right? And that's the tension that also exists. You talked about tensions. It's the tension of scholars who look at the past and see the problems of the present, and then systems which don't want particularly to have people looking at the problems of the present, and particularly when the problems are placed at their own feet. So, you know, how do we exist within an institutional system, but also be kind of counter-institutional or counter-systemic? It's a real challenge. And, you know, this kind of speaks to the need for broader social change, broader structural change, which, you know, unfortunately, maybe just can't happen just through us doing better in our classrooms, or, you know, just through decolonizing our classrooms. There needs to be a broader project to, you know, tear down some of these old systems and build something new in its place, which doesn't seem like there's a lot of appetite to do at this moment.
No, and we're going to try to illustrate that today as we talk about getting back to the classroom this semester. There's a reason we haven't done an episode, you know, since that late January episode on the AHA. It's because we've been doing something we have to call our jobs.
Yes, yeah, so yeah, let's get to that now. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. How does it feel to be an expert in a dying field? And how do you know it's over when you can't let go? You can't let go.
Okay, so it was, I don't know, maybe a year plus ago that I first went back in the classroom post-pandemic, or post-pandemic closures, we'll just say. I don't want to, you know, close the door on the pandemic because it's still very much out there in some ways. And so, you know, we dedicated time in an episode for me talking about, you know, my experience of being back in the classroom. And now this is the first semester you're back in the classroom. And so you've had a very, we'll just say, a very particular experience of coming back to campus, being in our classroom. We're sharing a classroom now as well as a podcast. So that's fun for the first time. So what's it been like being back at American River College, being in our Davies Hall, and then being in room 208, second floor of Davies Hall? If anybody wants to come find us, you can now know our exact location, by the way.
And you're more than welcome. Yep. In fact, most days I probably leave the door open while I'm teaching. Literally, the door is open. And we are roommates. That's right. It's really tested our relationship. where you leave the whiteboard marker.
You never do the dishes.
Where I never, you know, turn on the, leave the projector on or something. Right. Well, you know, I want to call this episode Driving Back to Chernobyl. How's that? Because that's how it felt. We call it American River College, but it felt like I was driving back into Chernobyl having been given the all clear by the managers, and I drove into that parking lot. You got to understand, I'm 25 years at this place, right? I drive in like it's the first day, like I'm a raw freshman, you know. It's like careful parking my car, and you know, I had my, you know, my wife packed me a lunch. No, she should have, darn it. That's how I felt, like the kid getting off the school bus, except now it was in the post-apocalypse. Going back to Chernobyl. I didn't know. I guess I'd been up a couple of months earlier to check on my office and to get a, the most important thing, let's cut to the chase, Josh. The most important thing is, do you have a parking sticker, you know? And so, yeah, I had my parking sticker. And all right, so I'm ready to go, man. You know, I got my top button probably buttoned, and you know, I was ready to do it. You know, I have to say, I mean, there's a lot we can say about coming back to work. It sort of fits into even the theme of the show today. But one thing that we noticed right away on the first day, because of course you had been there, you're right. You went in, I think, when the radioactivity was still glowing green, wasn't it? I mean, you were there. Nobody was there when you were back there in the spring of 2022. So I can imagine how raw everything must have been. You had a bunch of your ceiling tiles or something. What, there had been a flood in your office? I can't remember.
A couple times. But isn't that normal? Isn't that how most people's offices are? The water streams from the ceiling sometimes now?
Yeah. Well, certainly in Davies Hall, you know, which we're going to have some things to say about. But everything was electric because this is the job that I started at age 24, you know, still in grad school. And something happens for me, at least. I know it's true for you, that whatever else is going on in the world, you know, you cross that threshold into the classroom and, you know, it's go time, you know. Yeah. And I think that's how I'll know ultimately, you know, if it's time to hang it up. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember grad school sitting around with some of the old timers, you know, saying, oh, they had to rehearse their enthusiasm and this and that. And I'm not there yet. I'm happy to say, look, I don't like other aspects of the grind. But, you know, as far as when you walk into that classroom, all the best and worst things that have happened to me in life have been mediated in some ways by going into that classroom.
Yeah.
You know, whatever was happening on the outside, you know, for the next 50 minutes or you know, 80 minutes or whatever the length of the class, you know, that was in my element. You know, that's where it happens. So that felt great, you know, because teaching online, you know, it has a different stimulus, I guess. It has its own creative opportunities, but I don't think anything can quite replace the live set of a classroom, can it?
No, not at all. I mean, the stimulus of up online is there is no stimulus, really. It's accounting. And there's, you know, there's good and bad to it, certainly, but you don't get that stimulus. I mean, you very specifically do not get the stimulus of being in the classroom. You don't get the charge. You don't get the sense of this went well, this went poorly, you know, at least as clearly. There's an immediacy to being in the classroom that you just don't get from any other form of education, I think.
Right. And I think it's well to remember that, because a lot of what passes now for educational expertise or reform, you know, doesn't acknowledge that most primal fact of what it means for a teacher to be with students in a space, you know. Mm-hmm. You're on a committee this semester, a task force, they call it, to look at class size. And we could do a whole segment on that. You know, but let's suffice it to say that, you know, professors are wanting to cap or reduce class size. You know, there's probably not a lot of enthusiasm on the other side for that. Again, in the transactional model of education, stack them deep, teach them cheap tends to win out. But, you know, what we know, and you can put one of us or, you know, anybody in an amphitheater, 300, 400 students, and you'd still get the same charge. But there's something about walking into a classroom, you know, with a few dozen, couple dozen, whatever number of students are there, you know, and being in that live moment of it, you know, and I love it. I still love it. It's not like I can't compare it to any other experience, really. I mean, our classes are an hour and 20 minutes. My class goes from noon to 1:20, and you and I literally hand off the baton because you're in there before I do my thing, and then I finish, and then you come back in, right? So we should have a baton. We should have a literal baton. But that it seems like it goes by in 10 minutes for me. And I was aware of that, you know, and I always wanted to be like that for the students, Josh. I didn't want my students languishing. Now, I'm not always successful, you know, because my poor bunnies, you know, they come in, they have jobs, they have lives, you know, and they're tired. They're hungry, literally hungry, you know, because they haven't eaten. I got to start taking snacks again. I was doing that before COVID at night, but I realized at noontime students are hungry. And I asked them, I said, "Do you guys like that?" And they're like, "Oh yeah." So, you know, part of my job description, you know, feed the students, right? Because I have so much empathy for them. You know, they've been through so much. You know, the California Community College system is the great second chance, third chance, fourth chance, at whatever you want to call the American promise, the American, you know, promise of mobility, right? You know, and I happen to believe in the transformative power, if not the transactional power of education. So this is why I'm at American River College. This is why I left a four-year, you know, state university, you know, because this is where it's happening, right? The students you're talking to are as potentially they're going to make greater use of whatever it is we can do for them than almost any other category of student, you know? I mean, look, this is the moment where they can turn their lives around, you know, in some fundamental way. And so for them to be there, they don't have to come. I mean, I you know, I haven't bothered to break it down for him. You know, how many of you are getting financial aid? How many of you are here, you know, because it's part of your parole terms? No, I mean, I have no idea, you know, but they don't have to be there for the most part, right? And the fact that living in the slow motion apocalypse these days, they're bringing themselves not only to campus, but to my classroom, to your classroom, to history, you know, gives me a great sense of obligation to what we do in return for them. You know, it's not a sinecure, you know, look up that word. It's not just a privileged handout that we get to be professors, you know, and enjoy our tenure and our salaries and our benefits such as they are, you know, it's, we got a fucking obligation, you know, to do something for our students because they are in a position where something actually can change the direction of their lives. And my messianic tendencies notwithstanding, I don't think I'm the only player in that at all. But I feel that way when I go in. I might as well be Joe DiMaggio playing center field for the Yankees, Josh.
Yeah. No, there's that obligation. And I mean, again, the tension is that I think we're told our obligation is to provide them with education that can get them a job. And I'm like a step below that. I just want to provide them an education and a sense of history because it's inherently valuable to have a sense of history, right? But, you know, so it's, again, there's that challenge. The transactional model is what we're doing is offering them social mobility through a degree. And, you know, that's fine. I understand that. But I think we got to think of our own jobs as being more fundamental, right? It's about this historical education that is itself inherently valuable, regardless of its connection to, you know, a six-figure job or anything like that. And there's just not really a place for that, I don't think, in modern institutionalized higher education.
Well, there is in D208. How's that?
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
Inner sanctum or something. I mean, you know, when I was department chair all those years, I used to send off an email to you guys at the end of the year or whatever saying, you know, you're the truth tellers, right? Preach that fiery gospel, you know, a line I got out of the 19th century. Preach that fiery gospel. You know, you're there to tell the truth. And I think we all harbor that notion. I mean, the years I was department chair and would watch everybody teach and be on their evaluation teams and everything, you know, I never had a sense watching anybody teach that they didn't give a shit, you know, that they thought, well, this is, I just needed a job, so here's what I'm doing. I mean, the job is what it is. I mean, and for folks who, you know, like all of us trying to earn income, particularly for adjuncts, you know, having to go to two or three different campuses, find teaching here and there, opportunities to pay the bills, keep their health insurance going. I wouldn't stand here and deny all that. I'm not doing the job for free. In other words, Josh.
Yeah.
But we gotta somehow, I believe we were talking about it before the broadcast today, coming up in graduate school, the kinds of things we were introduced to, you know, that made us feel this was important. And so, okay, so there I am on the first day back in January, and I went to the bookstore to check on, you know, what was there, see, to make sure there was still a bookstore. And I'm happy to report there is. And they actually still do have some books in there. You know, it's not just all merch, you know. They
right.
Have some, and that there were actually students in there. I mean, all this is, you know, I'm scouting out the terrain. I feel like this is post-apocalypse reconnaissance on my campus, you know. And so I'm walking back, and the view I get of our building is now suddenly it's different, because a bunch of stuff was torn down. This was going on. The construction was going on before the quarantine for the construction of the new STEM building, right? Yeah. Which is named for one of a former ARC student, a woman student. I'm trying to think of her name. It's like Diane Taylor, maybe. I'm sorry, I don't have the name. It's emblazoned on the front of the building, so I should remember. She spoke at graduation 1 year. You know, the kind of success story that our admin love. And it's impressive. You know, she came as like a single mom or something to ARC and took some you know, some coding classes, computer science classes, and eventually, you know, worked her way up in Intel, the corporation in your hometown. It's like the Carnegie Steel of Folsom, right?
Yep. Intel. Yeah, that's right.
And so she worked herself up into high ranks of management at Intel and in Silicon Valley, breaking into the, you know, the mostly male world, toxically male world of Silicon Valley. So she came back and she gave a bunch of money, and it was really a cool story. But, you know, there's another side to this story, right? Because as much as we all love that kind of hero's journey, you know, the fact is that this, I call it the Crystal Palace next door, this new building, which used to be a quad, a place for, you know, students to hang out right before our classes, a kind of social space, you know, has become the STEM building. Now, I haven't gone in the STEM building yet. Have you?
No, my students have told me it's very nice.
I imagine it is. I think they have like crystal doorknobs and things like that.
I think so. We've been complaining all semester that the projector in our room is dim. It's so dim that it's almost impossible to see if the lights are not totally out. And I mentioned that in the first week, maybe, and one of the students said, innocently, not trying to stir things up, innocently said, the projectors aren't like that in the STEM building. I said, I assume that's true in the brand new STEM building. They have working projectors.
The sheen coming off the STEM building, the illumination actually lights up our classrooms right through the window where we have a combo seat for the STEM building. But yeah, so they had a balloon, like a bunting, you know, like a balloon arch to the front door of the STEM building. They had people in suits, a table with what looked like some tchotchkes, maybe giveaways. I don't know. They probably have their own T-shirts over there now. And if it sounds like I'm a little jealous, you know, I am in a way, only because of the battles we have to fight. You know, I can defend dear old Davies Hall like I did to the Board of Trustees a few years ago, if called upon. You know, it's not an ivory tower. You know, it's a squat Cold War era, you know, masonry structure. I think it was maybe actually a fallout shelter, wasn't it, Davies? I think for a while in the Cold War, it was.
It looks more like a fallout shelter than it does an academic building. I'll say that
There's a building, there's a basement. I don't know if you knew that there's a basement, but some strange subterranean part to the building, but no one would ever confuse it either for an Ivy Tower, Davies Hall, or for the STEM building for that matter, the gleaming Crystal Palace. So yeah, walking into D2A, which, you know, for over the years I've taught D2A at different times, but I hadn't been there in a while. Suffice to say, it'd been a minute, right, since I taught in that classroom. And a number of things, including the dim projection of the ceiling mount projector. You have to basically plunge the classroom into kind of half darkness to get a decent image on the screen. But even more telling right away were the old map sets in there. You know, somebody back in the day, our predecessors bought a bunch of map sets at one point, and they're still there. And they're Cold War map sets, because we were laughing about them on the way. And the one was literally crumbling. Right. I mean that the paper was actually so degraded, the map, that it was falling to pieces. You know, it was like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
It's turning to dust. Yeah.
Yeah. And then another one, that one of my students is sort of dry, you know, kind of observation, it killed me. He says, yeah, that one says Yugoslavia. I said, well, this is a museum. This isn't a classroom.
I was going to say, they're historical maps in more than one sense.
Exactly. Both, yeah. We had one nice map that we got back in the day when I was chair, but it was on the wall in the back corner.
I know.
The world map. And so it's like students had to crane their necks, you know, or do kind of a pivot in their seats. And I'm at the front of the room. It's in the back corner of the room. And it's like, oh, no. So we put together a little list of things and submitted it to our dean to an underwhelming response. Thank God for our admin, the office admin, a lovely woman who followed up on a number of the items that she could, at least, including getting the back of the room map put up in the front, near the front, where people could actually see it. They got us a laser pointer, which, I mean, my hand shakes too much. Laser pointer looks like a rock concert if I'm holding
it.
But other things, we're trying to get IT to give us a plug-in for our laptops, which they gave us. Here's a great example of organizational inertia and thinking, is that while we were on quarantine, they brought us new MacBooks, you and me, because we're always on the Apple side. And that's great. And the whole idea was mobile computing, that we could take them home and we could teach from anywhere, right? Except apparently our classrooms.
It's so crazy. There are mobile workspaces we can use anywhere except our classrooms.
Exactly. And so we put out a call, and, you know, the dude I know in IT, and I think he ultimately may come through for me, but you talk about guys that are overworked, you know, they're like the two maintenance guys at the place I lived in Cupertino before we moved to San Jose. Two maintenance guys for like 500 units. They're the busiest guys on campus, the IT guys. And, you know, it's like, can you just give us a little dongle or something we can plug our MacBooks into and use the screen? And it's like, oh, I don't know. It's like, well, that would really make it our job. And when we asked them to look at the projector, right, they went back to our admin and said, yep, works fine. We went through the whole protocol.
You know, it's an image on the screen. Yeah, that's what works.
Did they try teaching in the dark with 30 students in a room? I don't know if it works so good, you know, but anyway, these are normal things that we deal with. But I think what it, you know, it convinced me is that in this transactional world, that although we sound like paranoid fantasies when we talk about this stuff, that there's a certain tangible reality to it, because the condition of the classroom, the condition of the building, juxtaposed with the Crystal Palace, the STEM building, also suggests where budgets are going, where money is going in that transactional model. Because the idea in the STEM world, science, technology, engineering, math is what STEM stands for, is that those are where the jobs are. Those are the jobs. Right. And the hobby majors, as that one student put it, you know, over in Davies Hall. Well, not only are we down net three in terms of our full-time faculty, you know, we've made requests now for 2 years in a row. We got approval from the Senate, our faculty Senate, to get a new hire last year, but then it was cut at the president's level, ostensibly for budget reasons. We know that was total bullshit. And then this year again, they just said, well, we're not going to hire anybody in those disciplines. So an ostensible hiring freeze. Now, again, Josh, you know, being my therapist, you have to help me here, because, all right, so we've already lost two classrooms, literal classrooms in Davies Hall, to a counseling initiative. The same number of full-time faculty. We're down three, net three, 30%, 33% of our full-time faculty, with no plans to replace them. We are living in a managerial time now on the campus where our academic divisions are slated to be replaced with new entities run through counseling and new middle management deans, So in other words, taking the departments where they exist, in our case, in behavioral social sciences division, and putting it in a what they call home base, which is a counseling run entity, a matriculation entity, where we will report to someone who's not actually an academic dean in our in any of our fields.
Yep.
Right.
The report to part is I can't get past. I've never reported to anybody before. I don't have any plans to start reporting to my yeah. leadership team anytime soon either. But
yeah, it's that corporate speak, right? Yep. You know, so at a time of existential crisis for for our discipline. So in all of that, you know, I can affirm that being back in that classroom, you know, for that hour and 20 minutes for those students is revivifying, right? Mm-hmm. After the quarantine, it gets the juices flowing. It gets the creative juice. It's why we do what we do, essentially. And yet there was no way I could go back to it. Pick up the status quo ante, in other words, start doing things the way they'd always been done before, because how can we? The fact that History Against the Grain exists, a podcast, in the way that it does, the fact that we are at the American Historical Association, professional conference, et cetera, that we've had the guests we've had, et cetera, is that we're not going back to that. That something had to give. And, the story, my own anecdote story, driving home in 2018, 2019, driving home back to the South Bay, after teaching a night, early evening class, driving home, getting home about 9 o'clock that night, walking in, telling my wife, I'm guilty of malpractice. And, what I meant is that teaching the U.S. History Survey, the way that it had always been set up to be taught, was now borderline criminal for me to do that. That I was actually, in a sense, not just the steward of a dying field, but the steward of a field that was complicit. And boy, I didn't even know it was coming. I mean, yeah, Trump was already president by that point, but I've been through the Bush years too, Josh. We're the veterans of many political battles, right? Political wars, title changes. I was angry for 8 years, teaching U.S. history during the Bush years. And then suddenly... the disappointments of the Obama years. I mean, suddenly this was starting to run together seamlessly. And at some point, in the Trump years, I had to look in the mirror, and say, I think I'm part of the problem here, because I walk in there every class and tell these students about a story about the history of the United States that isn't fucking true. It's not true. And at least what it promises, because I was never just a stooge for the interests, I thought I was doing a kind of, more radical, edgy U.S. history, but I somehow entertained the conceit that that was going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And then George Floyd happened. And not only did George Floyd happen, but everything else then happened as a result, including our podcast, which said that this idea that we're living in a progressive, expansive freedom mode in a democracy called the United States of America was on its face a lie. This wasn't progressive. This was Groundhog Day. This was some kind of ghoulish Groundhog Day. And so you and I, 62 podcasts later, have arrived at a point where it seems impossible, to go back and somehow tell that narrative of a progressive, triumphal, expansive freedom story called the United States. Oh, sure, there have been conflicts, but with each conflict, we've emerged with a clearer sense, of inclusion, of democracy, of freedom. And then we get January 6th. And it wasn't like, it wasn't like the Branch Davidians, or Hayden Lake. This wasn't, Timothy, what's his name, blowing up the federal building in Atlanta or Oklahoma City. This wasn't some fringe thing. 72 million people voted for the asshole who was cheerleading the insurrection on January 6th with the crowd chanting Hank. hang Mike Pence. You know, if what we were doing in these history classes had made a damn bit of difference, particularly the U.S. history survey, this wasn't supposed to happen, was it?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, what you talk about here is fundamentally rethinking how you're going to teach this stuff, you know, now that you're back in the classroom. And I do want to stress that it's one thing to understand the problems of the field as it exists, or, you know, the manner of teaching these surveys as they exist. There is a kind of, what do I want to say? You know, you use the term stasis before. There's that stasis because it's hard work to rethink an entire class. It's hard work to rethink, you know, how you're going to present this stuff. And the stuff you've been doing is easy, always easy to come back to. It's always easy to do because, you know, at this point, you've been doing it for, you know, decades at this point. That stuff is kind of rote. You can get in any class and you can do that stuff. And if you want to make your job easy, that's the easiest thing to do. What you talk about here, though, is not just falling back into those same patterns, not just, you know, getting your wheels back in the same ruts, but thinking about how can we reshape this entire thing? How can we present the story in a fundamentally different way? And so, I mean, it seems like that's been your mission this semester, is to tackle every class session with this new and renewed focus on not repeating the same mistakes or the same, you know, patterns, I guess, that you used to bring in the class. You know, and as you said, it's not like you were ever, you know, particularly institutionalized in that sense, but there is that normalcy, that familiarity with the material you've been using. And there is, you know, that fear and danger of getting away from it, but it seems like that's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, look, we talked about it in earlier episodes. We talked about the episteme.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways it's easier to explain less academically as the matrix. When you're in the matrix, it's the most important thing, or the most difficult, but also the most important thing, is to know you're in the matrix, right? Because you might be thinking that you're somehow a free agent controlling the narrative or something like that, inspired by the good scholarship of things that are happening. But the matrix is the narrative, you know, and it's also the episteme that is the system that supports it. So, you know, a textbook, for example, open a textbook, the table of contents, U.S. history textbook, is going to be essentially the same from publisher to publisher. Mm-hmm. That's the episteme, right? That's the thing you're handed. Go ahead and tell your story, but just make sure you tell it within this narrative structure.
You got to hit the same beats, right? You can, the notes in between can be different, but you got to always hit those same beats, essentially. Yeah.
It's going to be the same song, right? Yep. Just played maybe slightly differently. You know, look, one of the things we did, you know, one of the first things I did, we used to laugh about, right? I read Hayden White's Meta History when we first went into the quarantine. I was sending you lengthy text excerpts from Hayden White, you know, and White was this guy who in the 70s, you know, was talking about historians and the art of narrative history, you know, and how little training we typically get as scholars, you know, in the art of narrative. You know, we just assume the narrative is already there, and that our job as empiricists is to find the right factual information to plug, you know, into the narratives. But, you know, this is the sort of thing that had me, you know, giving voice to that frustration, had me proclaiming that I was guilty of malpractice, because what I realized is that narrative shell hadn't changed. You know, what we call the U.S. history narrative. In our very first episode, we dealt with that, right? Of history against the grain. And so, look, I appreciate you saying, you know, it's a lot of work to change, to overthrow, you know, an entire, you know, narrative, established narrative, you know, sort of behemoth, you know, a kind of Alp, as Marx said, you know, is that it's a task that has to be carried out over time. But our first commitment, you know, in the podcast essentially was, all right, so where do you start? Step one, quit lying. So, okay. So we decided Western Civ, it's time to go. What we call things, Western Civ being a principal lie, this is, you know, and what we found out is that we had to educate ourselves. Our colleagues didn't really know. Where did that come from? You know, that was a course created not in Europe. It was created in the United States, mostly at Columbia University in the 20th century, early 20, during World War I, you know, at a time of hyper-nationalism and militarism. You know, Western Civ was sort of the historical manifestation of systems of nation states with their imperial ambitions, their militarism, et cetera. You know, obviously rabidly ethnocentric and pretentious. So quit lying. Let's get to the Western Civ. We're happy to report we're almost there, right? We're almost there. As soon, you've been the point person for this. Soon we will no longer have that freshman survey called Western Civ at our college. Is that correct?
We're getting there. I mean, it seems like, you know, every step forward, there's a new little barrier that comes up. But I assume eventually the barriers will all be gone. We'll just keep stepping over them and get to the next step. But yeah, I mean, it's a process, and it kind of speaks to the stickiness of these things. That, you know, it's one thing to recognize why they're wrong and how they're damaging. It's another thing within an institutional context to actually get rid of them. And, you know, it seems as if any kind of significant change, and I guess I should point out, you know, significant change, we're basically just changing a title of a class. And it's been a year long process, a year and a half, right? Just to literally change the name of the course in our course catalog without even touching the curriculum yet. And so it really does speak to just the, you know, that stasis of institutionalization of how we can make even simple changes. And what you're talking about is making more profound changes. And so, you know, in some ways we have more control in the classroom than we do in just renaming our classes. But yeah, there are barriers we've crossed, and there's barriers still to come, and we'll just keep crossing them.
Yeah, you know, this, they say of depression that it's a condition that resists treatment. Well, you know, whatever the academic equivalent, you know, the episteme, it resists reform. Mm-hmm. You know, and we had this idea of joining our colleagues across the district. There's four colleges in our district, of getting all the history departments, partly because we were bound to do that for some of the curriculum changes. We have to be consistent, is that we needed everybody to agree. And almost like in the, you know, sort of tragic comic episode of this, you know, we get the one outlier. I call him Bartleby, you know, the Scribner, if you know the Melville short story, you know, who says, no, I prefer not to do that. No explanation, just no, I don't want to do that. So, you know, screw us for thinking, you know, that we've diagnosed, we're doctors, we diagnose the history illness, and we can prescribe a treatment, right? But then we get, you know, all the anti-vaxxers coming in telling us, no, these actually will harm us. And yeah, it's been quite a surreal experience. As far as my classroom, though, really, it's beautiful, because a classroom is a beautiful space. The thing they're trying to kill in Florida, you know, and not for the first time, right? I mean, there's a history of this in the United States. I mean, there's a deep anti-intellectual tradition. You remember the Scopes trial, Josh, back in the 20s, or you couldn't teach, you know, evolution in Tennessee. Well, they threw a guy there. They arrested that guy too, right? John Scopes. They're trying to ruin it. They're always trying to ruin it, aren't they? But there's our inner sanctum. And all the things, their paranoid fantasies that we're doing, we're indoctrinating students in these radical... No, I was laughing with my students the first... I took the first 2 weeks just to talk about what does it mean to narrate the past. I didn't even get to, you know, fucking Christopher Columbus or pre-Columbian America. I mean, we were just talking, what does it mean to even say you're doing history, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, they're afraid that I'm going to come in here and I'm going to indoctrinate you. I'm going to brainwash you. And I'm like, can you imagine that? I can't even get my wife, you know, to buy me a certain kind of bread at the store. What? I mean, what power do I have? My kids, you know, you think my kids live? No, I didn't train them to listen to anything I had to say, right? The whole point, wasn't for us to indoctrinate anybody. Like we had that kind of what magnetism or something, you know.
Yeah.
The whole point was to get our students to think critically for themselves, you know, as lifelong learners. So it's amazing how that gets warped in the culture war, and that anti-intellectualism that sees us as academics as these sort of sinister Rasputin types that are turning, you know, we're the Socrates, you know, corrupting the youth of Athens, right? You see what they did to Socrates, you know, this is never really received very well by those in power. But how fundamentally it misreads what we're trying to do. And so, you know, instead of getting right into the curriculum model, you know, what we call the stuffed content curriculum, you know, we took 2 weeks and I was doing the Hayden White stuff. I said, what does it mean? Because you're going to hear a lot of claims about what history is, you know, what it should really concern itself, you know, what statues are and what curriculums are, the 1619 project, all that kind of stuff that gets caught up in the culture war. I want you guys to be able to make up your own mind, you know, about what seems credible, about what seems vital, what seems important. But to do that, we can't just turn the textbook upside down and dump out all its content. You know, we have to talk about what it means to cast a narrative, to tell a story. And that's not easy for us, Josh, as historians, because we weren't trained that way necessarily. Hayden White was a voice in the wilderness, you know, and because there were a few people who were able to critique him, people go, well, we don't have to worry about it anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we do have to worry about it, you know, we have to take it seriously. So I've really enjoyed talking about things like, what does it mean to talk about a history as an alternative history? You know, what does it mean to say of a narrative that it's, you know, that it's reductionist, or that there are certain narrative constructs? You know, I sent it to you, I think, one day, or told you, I had the word synecdoche upon the board. My prompt was, you know, my prompt was a three-word prompt: pilgrims, synecdoche, explain. And, you know, we were just doing an in-class write, a formative assessment, nothing high stakes. Let's just see if this is making any sense. And I told him, I said, you guys are guinea pigs. I'm doing this thing completely different. Let's have fun with this. Let's see. And I said, don't worry about that STEM building over there. You know, they tell you that's where you're going to get your job. You know what you get here? You get through the job interview with this class. This is what we train mm-hmm. you to do, you know, is be able to speak for yourself in an informed way and impress upon somebody. You know what you're talking about. They don't tell you that. They just think by walking in a STEM building, you're going to get a job automatically. But Facebook just, you know, laid off 10,000 people, you know. So, okay. So we have some fun with it, you know, but to pilgrims, synecdoche, explain, because, you know, all I want to know is if they're developing a vocabulary, developing a certain ease with being able to talk about history from that kind of meta-historical perspective, that the story of the pilgrims coming to Plymouth Rock, the traditional sort of orientation, you know, orienting point, center point of an American narrative that was itself retrofitted in the 19th century, didn't have really much to do with those that were called pilgrims, you know, that we can talk about these things. Where do these stories come from? What do they ask us to believe? How do they limit our understanding of a more complicated past, you know, a more contentious past, which after all, living in the age we do now, is nothing if not contentious. It would seem those would be valuable tools for us to have at our disposal to be able to mediate the contention, the disputes, the claims, you know, the post-factual world of media, and I mean, whatever it is that we're always dealing with, you know. And so, yeah, that's what I want. My learning outcome for my students, I want them to be dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool. And it's, you know, you can kind of hear your excitement when we talk about this kind of stuff. Because yeah, it was 3 years basically that you were not in the classroom. And you had all this stored up, you know, passion and ways of thinking, you know, new ways of thinking that you hadn't been able to. I mean, we talked about it in the podcast, but you know, as we talked about, there's something different about being live with a group of people and trying to introduce them to something that is new and exciting. And I, you know, it's really cool that you're now getting a chance to do this. And you know, maybe you talk about the malpractice of what you had done in the past. This is, you know, your kind of atonement for that is that
reframed.
And I don't want to be too melodramatic here, but you know, this is your chance to put into action the stuff that you've been thinking about, which, you know, again, I want to stress, it's very easy to stay on the same track you've been on. And, you know, I always think of it like, you know, what's the thing about you lose skin cells. And so basically every 7 years, you're a new person. That's kind of how your classes work as well, is that, you know, we tool around the edges a little bit. And so over time, the stuff becomes different, but that's not what you're doing here. You're basically just throwing the whole thing out and you're building something new in its place.
No, I think both of us, I mean, you know, we're partners in this venture because, you know, it was this podcast, you know, and we did something and, you know, and it's no fault to modesty, Josh. I'm going to frankly avow, you know, it's very, and I have empathy for colleagues, you know, because you have all this vital stuff that happens to you in grad school where everything is revelation, you know, and you're jumping into the deep end of this scholarly enterprise, you know, and it's so incredibly stimulating. And then what happens? You get a full-time job and it's like, oh Christ, you know,
never use that stuff again.
It's a grind, you know, and you and I have both lamented. I've talked you down from the ledge. You've talked me down from the ledge, you know, where we say, geez, are we just, you know, we sold out? What are we doing? You know, and so listen, we should be having those conversations. And what we did with this podcast was we jumped back into the deep end of the pool. I had to go back to a discipline I'd really walked away from 20 years earlier, you know, the U.S. history thing, early U.S. history, you know, where I was originally trained, you know, but had gone into world history. You know, this is a rearview mirror for me, and go back and find out what had happened in 20 years. And I would say this, we have to be better, you know, in terms of our existential crisis and how to meet it. We have to be better at that. You know, even the conversation we had today with our colleagues across the district about getting rid of the Western Civ label was a really fruitful conversation. And yes, if one of our colleagues decided, well, you know, it wasn't for him or whatever, I guess that's what you come away with. But generally speaking, I thought it was really fruitful. We have to be better at that kind of professional development, because otherwise 20 years of the profession gets left behind. You know, it's hard. It's not incentivized. You know, what the institution wants us doing doesn't really, they don't care about that kind of professional development.
No, they really don't.
Really. You know, so we have to get better at that, because what you and I did by jumping back into the deep end has made all the difference. And I credit you with being a willing partner with that. I couldn't have done it without you. There would have been no way, you know, that somehow in my little quarantined, you know, study, that somehow I could have even begun to lift these heavy rocks, you know? So we have to figure out a way to scale this up so that others do it, you know, because not only do you hear the passion in my voice, it's come back from it, you know, but that's the lifeblood of what we should be doing, you know? And so, yeah, I have a lot of empathy for our colleagues, but I also have a certain expectation that they need to get in gear with this, you know, and to begin insisting on this, to go to their senates and, you know, their professional development sessions, and insisting that we get these kinds of opportunities to rethink the courses we're teaching, you know, to get out of that matrix mode and to understand, because otherwise we're not going to make it. You know, the transactional model, we can't win on their terms. You know,
that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're setting a playing field that we just don't have, cannot compete in. Even as you noted, like Facebook laid off 10,000 people and Zuckerberg said 2023 is a year of efficiency. And, you know, so there you go. There's your Brookings Institute guy, you know, talking about the efficiency of the New York public schools. And
God.
And right? Here we go. Yeah.
Yeah. So we can't, you know, beat them on that game. All we ended up doing is selling our soul, you know, to the Cold War dividend or something, you know. Yeah. But we got to be radical. We have to be insistent. We got to be on point with this stuff. And it ain't easy because you only have so many energy molecules to expend at any given time. But, you know, there's strength in numbers. And I think ultimately, we have to re-seize the opportunity, you know, of the momentum of the initiative to say, We are the disciplinary experts. We are the teachers of record. You know, Josh, you've been in the game 20 years. I mean, you can speak with great authority on what happens in a classroom, you know? And so whether it's giving a list of to-dos, you know, to our office to say, we need this in our classroom, we need these things fixed. You know, we need these tools to support what we're doing, but then at the same time, taking the deep dive into our own profession, because you know what I found out after being gone for 20 years from early U.S. history, there's some remarkable things that have been going on, you know, by some of our research colleagues, some of our writers, some of our professional, you know, colleagues who do that work, who get in those archives and raise these questions. And it's made all the difference to understanding. And so unless we're willing to do this, you know, as a profession, as a professoriate of history, we have no reason to think that our discipline as an academic discipline will even will survive.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even if you take the darkest view, like that this is, it's that we're doomed and the discipline is doomed, you know, even if you're taking that view, if we're doomed anyway, let's go down doing what we believe in and not, you know, continue to play the same notes, because that's what we think they want, because it's not saving us to play their game. And so Right. Let's just keep playing our own game and see how it works out.
Our job has always been subversive. Education has always been subversive. You know, so much of what has been redesigned in the transactional model, you know, is that education is just adjunct to corporate America, you know, and we're training worker drones. And listen, I don't want to be too flip about this stuff. I understand you got to earn a living in this world, you know, but what I want my students to understand is ultimately they need to make qualitative existential choices for themselves. You know, so that not only do they find jobs, but they can find jobs that are going to be relatively happy, and they can flourish and feel they have some kind of creative autonomy or something. And you know, given the times that we live in, all the more reason then to be armed with a certain critical edge as you approach that, you know. And so far, I have to tell you, I mean, I adore my students. I have nothing but empathy for them. The students are the answer. They're not the problem. You know, when I hear people talk about students in just sort of, you know, kind of critical terms, you know, there's a long song that teachers sometimes sing about, well, students these days. And it's like, yeah, no, yeah. I love these students. You know, they have survivors. And that's why you got to do right by them. You know, we got to equip them with these tools and this edge. And it's the last, to me, it's the last best shot we got as a discipline, you know, to demonstrate our inherent worth. And I don't know, maybe we got to hit bottom. Maybe Facebook, you know, more Silicon Valley banks got to fold. We have to go through another Great Depression. There's a kind of pendulum effect of these things, right? Maybe, you know, Facebook has to lay off 50,000 more people. Or something. I don't know what maybe Florida has to reach a critical mass where teachers, you know, it's like the Cultural Revolution in China, teachers are being paraded around town on donkeys with dunce hats or something. Yeah. I don't know what's rock bottom that we got to hit before this more, I would like to think, this moral clarity that we've tried to gain in our pursuits. Suddenly people are saying, you know what? Yeah, let's do that. And you know, I joke around about being messianic. It's not a messiah. It's just a kind of clarity about the lives we want to live and the stories we want to tell ourselves. I've lived a whole damn life.
Head into our final segment. Just a few last words before we let you go. You know, there's been a lot of pieces lately about, you know, the kind of crisis of the humanities. You know, the piece in the New Yorker by I think the writer was Emma Green, and she had a lot of new stuff about Jim Sweet, which was a painful thing to read. I think we're going to talk about it, but we've probably talked about him enough, given him enough attention. Another piece that was getting a lot of attention was in the New Yorker as well, and it was called "The Death of the English Major." And it explored you know, basically, you know, not just English major, but the humanities and social sciences more broadly and what's happening in them. And the piece was, I don't know, very open to critique because it focused on a few elite universities, as such pieces often did, and, you know, turned these stories about what's happening at Harvard and Columbia and you know, these small private liberal arts colleges into broader narratives of higher education. Those narratives almost always don't take into account where students actually are, which is in places like American River College, you know, in colleges and universities that, you know, are not competitive in terms of getting in, and are offering the promise of, you know, and a higher education of people who otherwise wouldn't get it. And so the piece was tough to read because you're hearing all these people who are in such different situations than, again, most tenured faculty or even adjunct faculty, and then students who really are not representative of any kind of norm for students in higher education. And so what was so amazing in this piece is that right towards the end, we get a moment of clarity where somebody cuts through all the bullshit that's been spouted throughout. And it was an undergraduate student at Harvard University, because again, that's where the piece focused. And I'll call him out by name. His name is Saul Glist, described as a tall history and literature major. And so the piece has been lamenting, you know, the downfall of these kind of academic disciplines. You said earlier, it's in this piece that somebody referred to history as a hobby, as opposed to a serious academic study. And this guy, Saul Glist, says he'd been drawn toward this field of history and literature because in his humanities classes, he felt like a student absorbing information and more like a young, he felt less like a student absorbing information and more like a young thinker, which is kind of what you were referring to earlier, that he kind of came to see the value of this stuff, despite the fact that everything around him was telling him that those subjects did not have value. And he gives the kind of key quote in the entire piece, a quote that probably didn't get enough attention in the piece that was kind of placed towards the end, after all these, you know, more prestigious scholars got to speak. He says, "I think it's really a question of what the university is investing in. When you're telling touring students, this is our shiny new building. That is the jewel of our expanding campus." He's talking about a STEM building on Harvard's campus. He could just as well be talking about the STEM building on our own campus, though. And are making no visible investment in the humanities, that creates a narrative. He believed, the author says, that universities were all too happy to accept plummeting humanities enrollments because the story of decline created its own vortex, one that drew away duties that the university, in its present pursuit of growth and revenue, might prefer not to deal with. And I think it's always worth remembering that, you know, this rhetoric about the decline of the humanities, the death of these majors, is itself a narrative, as Liz points out, that does create its own vortex. And so as much as we can, we need to continue to fight and push and argue for the inherent value of what we do. And that value cannot necessarily be monetized always. It can't always be measured in wealth and earning potentials. But if we truly believe in what we're doing, then we need to be making that case every single day we're in our classroom, every time we're at, you know, a faculty meeting, every time we're on a committee somewhere. We got to be making that case for why it's valuable, why it needs to be protected, and why it needs to continue to survive.
Yeah, you're right on there, Josh. In a transactional model, the narrative is one of quantity. You go to this particular building to earn this particular job with this particular salary. Mm-hmm. It's quantitative. The transactional model says life is quantitative, and there seems to be an assumption that a quantitative life, a life of quantity, equals a well-lived life, right?
Right.
And I think that's where we disagree, you know, because we say that there is no particular imperative, you know, to live a good life simply because you're living a life of a certain quantitative measure, as measured, let's say, in income or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I know this, by the way, because I was online. I was looking at the most expensive divorce cases in history. And these are all people, very wealthy people you've heard of, who were divorced, and the sums that were granted in the divorce decrees is extraordinary. And so I was thinking, well, I guess they weren't that happy. That is brutal divorce. I guess they weren't that happy. But seriously, we're talking about a transformational model of education as a counterpoint to that, which says we want our students to be equipped, to understand what a good life is, and then how to square that with the need for a certain kind of job with a certain kind of income, but not the other way around, not assuming that the transactional model will ultimately ensure you a good quality of life. So is that radical, a radical narrative? I think it is in this sort of bottom line, the cost accounting world that we live in. But, the quote there that you presented, I think, comes direct from the student, right?
Yeah.
Who is saying qualitatively, this is a different and more meaningful experience.
Yeah.
We ought to do everything we can to support that.
Absolutely. Well, this has been episode 62. We will try to be back as soon as we can. As Chris mentioned earlier, the pressures of the semester are such that it's been harder than we intended. I feel like we're becoming like a British TV show where you get like three episodes a year and they're all like 4 hours long. And then there's a random Christmas episode also. This is our spring break episode in our podcast season. But we'll try to be back as soon as we can. Certainly during the summer, we'll try to be more frequent in doing these recordings. We just appreciate all you listeners, and spread the word, tell your friends, subscribe, do all that stuff, and we will be talking to you again as soon as we can.
Nobody is innocent. It's a sin when you play into ignorance. Another one closing your eyes again, so you don't have to see what's happening. Then now what's going on in these streets? You can't live by what you see on TV. Stuck in a cycle, so we repeat. Stuck in a cycle, so we repeat.